Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and has been broadcast on Preston, Swindon and St Albans Community Radio. Bristol Community FM's chair and manager have, however, suspended Dialect indefinitely due to a nearly 30-minute long excerpt of a speech by Bible scholar Gail Ripplinger. This week, a Syria special with Patrick Chalmers, the author of Fraudcast News, former Reuters journalist, and Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire, a website in the United States that looks at geopolitics, really against the wishes of the mainstream media. Dialects produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And you can contact us via Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square on 0117 989 7733, or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Patrick Chalmers. I suppose the most accurate way to describe me at the moment is as an independent journalist doing various projects related to journalism and occasional freelance work. I formerly was a salaried reporter for the Reuters news agency for 11 years, ended in 2005, after which I wrote a book called Fraudcast News, How Bad Journalism Supports Our Bogus Democracies, which used my experience of being a journalist in Reuters and also observing my peers during that time to sort of argue what a poor job most journalists were doing of getting behind the very superficial headlines to look at structures of power, look at the realities of what we call democracy, and digging into who takes decisions and who benefits from those decisions.
Patrick, were you working during the run-up to, it sounds like you were, the Iraq War? I wonder if you've got any observations about what led to that, because that now, looking back on it, doesn't seem to have been a very democratic war or a decision to go to war.
Well, I was working for Reuters during that time, and related to that, I suppose, I was also working for Reuters at the time of the Twin Tower attacks. I was in Malaysia when the aircraft hit the Twin Towers, and I was actually working in what claimed to be the world's tallest building at the time, the Petronas Towers. And we, the day after the attacks, were sort of evacuated from there. And Malaysia as well is a majority Muslim country. And what was interesting from a professional point of view was that up until those attacks, the 9/11 attacks, we journalistically were covering things like detention without trial, human rights abuses, and those sorts of stories as they were happening to political dissidents in Malaysia and people like the Australian government who were complaining about the way Malaysia was behaving. But very quickly, those sorts of stories related to human rights, basic universal human rights, just disappeared off the radar, and we got into what we're still living now, which is a narrative of the war on terror and terrorism and terror suspects and the right of states to railroad over basic rights in the interests of, inverted commas, security.
What have you seen over the years in the way that owners and, you know, I suppose I'm talking about the bosses that often don't appear on TV? We don't know necessarily their names. We wouldn't know them if we passed them in the street. What influence do they have on our mainstream media? I'm talking about things like these news wires, like Associated Press, Reuters, people like that.
Well, it's never quite as clear as some sort of central casting, you know, evil boss with a cigarette or a cigar in his mouth and a pinstripe suit on. The pressures are more subtle and in a way more all pervasive. It's really a question of what stories your editors ask you to do over others that you might yourself think might be more important. You also see it in the sense of certainly within Reuters at the time, and I have no reason to believe it's any different now. Thinking about what the client wants, and for an organization like Reuters, now Thomson Reuters, the client is invariably a bank or an investor or even a government, certainly someone who is interested in mainstream conventional economic and finance thinking, financial markets thinking, rather than a citizen, one of the 7 billion members of the human race.
Well, hang on, because I thought that the people who read these news stories were the clients. And, you know, for many of those news stories, they just get sold to mainstream newspapers and they appear on our newspapers in the morning. So are you saying that there are other agendas when people are deciding what's news and what isn't?
Most certainly. If you look at what Reuters says about its news, and if you look at what a lot of news organizations say about their news, and if you see what a lot of journalism bodies talk about as the principles of journalism, there's an awful lot of sort of hocus pocus about holding power to account. Reuters talks about speed, accuracy, freedom from bias. There's 9 principles of journalism which are very fine sounding, which include the idea that journalists' first duty should be to citizens. So there's a lot of fine talk, but some fairly basic media analysis. People like Chomsky looking at the filters that affect what sort of news comes out includes front and center the effects of ownership and the effects of revenue sources on what news is put before the public.
When you say revenue sources, I mean, surely major revenue source for someone like Reuters is going to be newspapers like The Guardian and The Independent that pay them for the articles that they reprint and that they use in their newspapers.
You'd think so, but in terms of percentage, for a company like Thomson Reuters, it's minute. The vast majority, and I think it's in the low 90%, is the sale of data feeds, hardware to transmit the data feeds, for share prices, bond prices, commodity prices, real-time, super high-speed financial information, and also headlines related to market-moving news as well, so that they ensure that they have the highest possible speed delivery of that in order to be able to real-time trade changing prices. You know, if news has a big effect on a bond price or a stock price or a stock price of an individual company or a whole stock market.
So if people like The Independent, The Guardian, The Times, etc. are only, you know, something like 10%, the other 90%, who are these companies?
It's no great, it's nothing particularly revelatory. It's banks, it's financial institutions, it's people who want to have as up to the second information in order to be able to protect whatever either whatever position they have in the market or to be able to analyze what's going on, to trade as well. Some of the software and hardware that's sold or leased relates to the process of actually dealing as well and communicating with counterparties to a sale or purchase of a stock of some sort.
So what guarantee is there that what we're getting is the news that the public need to hear? Because, I mean, surely that was the whole point of organisations like the BBC when they were first created before the Second World War, between the wars, that this is a government-run and owned service which is really paid for by taxpayers, not by banks and not by the City of London's financial institutions.
Well, it's true. The BBC is paid for I don't know exactly how it breaks down. I'm not an expert in the BBC, but there is still the license fee and the idea that it's a public broadcaster. It has a different set of pressures to an organization like Reuters. Obviously, its funding is not determined by individual members of the public and the public interest. It's dependent on politicians of one party or the other who have a political interest in saying what they have to say about the news, and also with a whip hand, as it were, over the news if it's not to their liking. I mean, we've seen, you know, various instances of it in the past. With regard to revelations by the BBC, the famous dodgy dossier, Andrew Gilligan, and all the rest. But there's been plenty more pressure since, and it only seems to increase.
You mentioned democracy. How is democracy affected by the media and the ownership of it? Because it's really important, isn't it? We're getting some. We've had the Iraq war that started really over really the space of just a few months, and these allegations of weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be false. And now we're into bombing Syria. I've just literally today come from a demonstration here of students in Bristol, where a lot of people seem to be saying, well, hang on, we're not getting democracy here in Britain. So how's democracy affected by the media, do you think?
Well, I think the people you saw in Bristol have got as sharp a grasp or perspective on democracy as I would claim to have, and probably you too. We don't live in a democracy. You look at the first past the post system in the United Kingdom and how many MPs you get for the votes that are cast, and you can see that it's an extremely imperfect form of choosing representatives. That is before you even get into the question of how imperfect a process, elections and voting is for choosing a representative sample of people to govern the country. There are all sorts of innovations in terms of choosing our governors, which have not got to a national level yet, but which I would confidently predict will do relatively quickly, given the state of our government systems. And I hesitate to use the word democracies because I don't think they are. Democracy had a very clear meaning as to the originators of the word. It's government by the people. What we have is not democracy at the moment. It's not government by the people. You can see that by whose interests are served by our Western systems of government. Increasingly, we should be talking more about oligarchies, which is ruled by the wealthy and an elite few, rather, plutocracy, which is ruled by the wealthy. We bandy words like oligarch around when it's sort of Russian owners of football clubs or dodgy, you know, Russians owning energy companies or whatever. But you could just as accurately use those terms for some of the companies that influence government in Britain or also the European Union. And you could say the same for, Treasury services and certainly the United States government as well. So, you know, what's the state of democracy? We don't have a democracy. What should we be doing about? And because we don't have a democracy, the fact that people don't want the United Kingdom to be bombing Syria is neither here nor there. It's not up to them to take the decision, and they haven't got a means of expressing that opinion other than by going on the streets and shouting a bit and probably having their views distorted by most of the media as well.
But what about the role of the media in actually creating the climate whereby a decision like that can be made in the first place? I just wondered whether you think that the media is doing its job in holding politicians, you're saying they're not really reflecting the views of ordinary people. But, I mean, the media's job surely is to hold those politicians to account. Are they doing that?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, the coverage of, you know, whether or not you like Corbyn, the coverage of Corbyn as the new leader of the opposition is spectacularly hostile and disingenuous. So that's one, or a large section of the UK conventional media is basically not taking anything that he has to say with any sort of seriousness, and not taking the fact that so many people voted for him to get the position he has. So they're certainly failing on that level. But I mean, even you know, the likes of The Guardian with the vote on Syria, I did my best to see what it was in Hillary Benn's speech that everyone was going on about as being such a spectacular example of rhetoric, unless it was using the term rhetoric as a term of insult, which is, again, to be using a speech in order to dissemble and pull the wool over people's eyes. You know, if you listen to what Hillary Benn had to say as for his arguments for backing the government position, it was, the logic was shot full of holes, if you ask me, and certainly was blithely ignoring the evidence of the last decade or so of the UK, you know, running in lockstep with the United States on foreign policy.
But he was citing, wasn't he, fascism? He was saying effectively that what was going on now with ISIS is comparable to Franco in Spain, Mussolini in Italy, and Hitler in Nazi Germany.
Fascism is obviously a very provocative term, and in fact, funnily enough, it's something that I've been increasingly interested in as a notion. Over the last 10 years, and when I look at things like global trade policy and the way that that is being sorted out, when I look at the grip that corporate interests have on something like climate change negotiations, which obviously is very current, when I look at things like the institutional structures of the European Union or the World Bank or the IMF, and corporate capture of those various different institutions. When you look at lobbying in the European Union, when you look at lobbying in the United States or the UK, the notion of sort of lockstep between corporate interests and their representatives almost in government, that has me reaching for dictionaries and historical textbooks which describe fascism. ISIS is not a fascist organization, as in my understanding of the term fascism. It's certainly a theological nut job, and a deeply frightening and shocking one. But it's not, fascism is not really the term that would spring to mind when I was looking at ISIS.
I know you've also taken an interest in the climate talks that have been going on in Paris, Patrick. I wonder if you could sum up what your thoughts are about, you know, number one, I suppose, what's actually being achieved there, and secondly, how it's being reported.
Well, what's being achieved there, it seems to me like a gigantic snow job, and obviously that's a winter, a weather metaphor, but I went as a reporter with Reuters to Kyoto. I went as an independent sort of investigator of civil disobedience to Copenhagen, which was both of those, Kyoto and Copenhagen, 1997 and 2009 respectively, were sort of earlier versions of what's going on in Paris with these international talks to try and get some sort of agreement on how to reduce emissions. I'm not expecting anything substantial out of Paris, even if victory is declared by the French hosts come Friday. I think the Democracy Now! is a news program that I listen to regularly, and I think they've had a couple of interviewees on this week or in the last 10 days who have made clear to what extent Paris is going to miss the mark. There was a fellow from the Tyndall Centre who's in the UK speaking in the last couple of days, saying that it's far too little, it's not binding, it ignores things like historical responsibilities of the likes of the United Kingdom and the United States, who have been polluting for a couple of centuries, and so have a historical legacy of pollution which far outweighs that of other parties. And, you know, I think it was 300 millimetres of water or something fell on the Cumbrian Hills this weekend, and this is at 1 degree centigrade. You know, the sense of urgency and seriousness with which politicians are tackling the issue of climate change is way wide of the mark. It's nowhere near what's required. So regardless of what the media jump up and down and shout, the conventional media, I think what will come out of Paris is going to be way short of what's required.
I suppose the obvious question is why, because it's a bit like Syria, Patrick, and Iraq, isn't it? You know, you say, well, nobody wants a war. Why do you think that these, it's impossible to get to bang heads together and get something done on climate change? It's quite clear that there is something going on, even if you're a bit of a sceptic with the planet, that there is climate change happening. No one's really doubting that. Nobody's serious anyway. So why is it so difficult to get some real change?
The issues are sort of related. You know, my concerns about the media and their failure is related to corporate capture of the media and the influence of ownership on media and various other factors. But those same influences have had their same damaging effects on political structures. When I was in Kyoto in 97, there was the threat of a Senate veto hanging over the US position. So at the time, it was Clinton and Gore, and sort of Gore, the vice president of the time, sort of rode in on his white charger as a great savior of the talks. And to be fair, negotiators reached a deal which was going to bind the richer countries to emissions cuts by a certain time, by a certain amount, and all that sort of stuff, which then when Clinton was approaching the end of office and when Bush... George W. Bush came in, he just kicked it into touch, basically. And from the political reality perspective, the structure of the US political system was never going to agree to the Kyoto Protocol anyway. So the reason that is because the US political system is bust. It can't get a it couldn't get a climate change deal through because it's so up to its arms in corporate money and corporate interests and, you know, people in revolving door jobs into administration, out into law firms or lobby groups or into corporate jobs, you know, themselves. You know, the political system is broken and the media are incapable of joining the dots to see quite how badly broken it is and to what extent it needs to be root and branch reformed.
So finally, do you think there's any light at the end of the tunnel? Because we can't carry on like this, certainly with these various crises brewing. It's almost like sort of all of them simmering menacingly on the stove. We've got the financial crisis. We've got the potential of wider conflicts going on in the Middle East now, particularly with NATO and Russia fighting in Syria, a very dangerous situation there, and also, of course, with the climate. So can you see some light at the end of the tunnel for us, Patrick?
What sort of philosophical question is that, Mr. Gosling? I mean, you know, if you cover environmental issues, let's leave aside all of the other ones. You look at the metrics of climate change, you look at the metrics of species loss, you look at the metrics of resource use. Any one of those is pretty alarming. And so if you have children and grandchildren, or you have people who are dear to you who have children or grandchildren, then there is certainly the wherewithal to be alarmed. Do you want to live in a perpetual state of alarm? I don't think there's any point. The same fellow interviewed by Democracy Now! From the Tyndall Center was talking along the lines of, I haven't got much hope in this process, but what else can I do? And so that is the approach that I take myself, and I would encourage other people to take, which is that things don't look good at all. But, you know, what do you want to do in the face of that? Do you want to make all your friends miserable, or do you want to think what needs to be done and what can I personally do to try and help? I think that's the choice that I make personally. Obviously, people will make their own choices, but it's the only way forward as far as I can see without sort of going stark raving bonkers.
Well, I think it's also the approach that hundreds of students took today here in Bristol. They, you know, decided to turn out to voice their protest against the bombing of Syria, which they were pointing out again and again. They were saying, well, how is bombing civilians, which we're going to be doing, actually going to help us at all. It's not. It's just going to be a recruiting tool for ISIS. In many ways, it's exactly what they want us to do to succeed. But anyway, Patrick, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
It's a pleasure, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Patrick Henningsen, and I am the founder of 21stCenturyWire.com. It's a news website. Initially, it was just kind of a really low-level blog, low-budget blog. It still is a low-budget blog, but we try to do high-end news analysis and get into the geopolitical realms and a number of other subjects. So, you know, trying really hard to drill down to, you know, the real issues and look at the inner workings and see how the gears are turning in terms of power and all the other issues that surround that, you know, like energy, politics, history, and other sort of structures, unilateral, multilateral institutions, and how all these things feed into what we see as the news playing out in front of us. And of course, what we're going to give you is very different from what you might be getting on the mainstream media. So that's because we're looking at it from a different prism altogether. We're trying to anyway, doing our best with the resources we have. But I think we do a better job than a lot of mainstream media outlets do with one millionth of the operating budget.
Patrick, your take on recent events, please, because, I mean, you're talking there, you even talked about history, didn't you? One of the things that we haven't really been taught about or told about at all in our current affairs is the parallels that a lot of people are drawing, particularly in the Middle East, not necessarily in Europe, because they're not being explained their history, the parallels with what's going on now to the medieval Crusades.
That's definitely a valid comparison. It's the you've got the medieval Crusades. You've got a number of other things that you can also compare this to. There are a lot of big agendas at play, Tony, here, not just the military agendas and not just the conquering of territories. Those things that you can really analyze, and they sort of play out, and there's a lot of different we all have skill sets that we can do to analyze this. There's other agendas, though, that are a lot deeper and a lot more over a longer period of time. And with regards to the Middle East, we can get into this. I know you want to talk about Syria and Turkey, but there is a definite push in the West. I monitor talking points in media, and I see patterns that emerge. And one of the patterns which has been emerging over the last 12 months has been talk of a reformation of Islam. And this is primarily calls coming out of the West, mainly backed by certain foundations and think tanks from the United States, although there's a few affiliates in Europe as well. And so we see this talking point coming out, and pundits are just repeating this in the wake of various so-called terrorist attacks like San Bernardino and Paris, is we need to do something about Islam. We need to reform it. It's a violent, radical religion by nature, and therefore it must be subdued. And we need to do this, and Christianity had a reformation, and et cetera, et cetera. So what I see, Tony, here is this is kind of big picture, long range social engineering that really comes down as a kind of a colonial, traditional kind of colonial tool. This has been done throughout history to divide, basically divide and conquer, to subdivide, you know, religious followings and within nations and within regions, and have this is to compartmentalize what used to be unified. It would now be compartmentalized, and that's an ongoing process, Tony. It's not something that is going to happen tomorrow. This is a long-range agenda, probably over the next 100 years or 200 years, I guess.
What you're talking about there sounds almost like Syria, doesn't it? Compartmentalizing it, dividing up into bits.
Yeah. So that's definitely on the cards. I would say that's definitely in the direct foreign policy directives of Washington. There's another one that's emerging, which I'd love your comment on, Tony. Ash Carter just testified in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee today, and he reiterated a talking point which we had brought up at 21st Century Wire over the last couple of weeks, which is the talk of an EU army. So Ash Carter was saying that, you know, the Europeans need to do more. The Europeans, our German partners, our French partners, etc., need to do more, and they need to invest more in their military. So if you look at the problem and the crisis caused with NATO, you have a potential NATO meltdown right now with a sort of bad actor stroke ugly stepchild being Turkey, and also some fundamental flaws in the NATO system. In other words, NATO's is really hit the wall. It's gone about as far as it can go in fooling the public as to what its remit really is in the 21st century, because it's really a relic of the Cold War. And B, countries are supposed to voluntarily contribute to it, and they're not all up to scratch. There's only one or two countries that are actually truly meeting their NATO obligations in terms of spending 2% of their GDP on military spending and, you know, really taking leadership roles, if you will. But it's also hamstrung by the nature of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So this Article 5 is one of the only ways that you can mobilize the collective. And they've managed to cheat it a few times. And I think Libya was it was a mixed blessing for NATO. Got away with murder in Libya by cheating a UN resolution, but at the same time they hamstrung potential future operations. So basically that was the final sort of card, if you will. They laid their whole hand on the table in Libya, and to me that's that was the death knell of NATO as we once knew it, and it must be replaced by an EU army. And we've had calls from various leaders. Tony Blair mentioned it in his speech at the Henry Kissinger lecture series just a few days ago. David Cameron and Angela Merkel are doing some horse trading with regards to the EU, and the quid pro quo is Britain's going to be more considerate towards this idea of an EU army. But basically, Tony, I think it's a done deal, but it's just finding the political structures in public to make it seem like it's a good thing to have a federal army in Europe.
Well, we also have heard quite a lot over the last few weeks of this organisation, Europol, particularly since the Paris attacks several weeks ago, which is a European-wide police force. There's definitely an attempt to create this kind of United States of Europe. I would also add that I don't think that many of the British police forces or any of the regiments in the British Army be particularly happy about just being literally under some kind of European command. Although, of course, they do go around the world where other NATO generals are in command of British troops from time to time. They certainly don't want that kind of thing to be happening permanently. So there may be a bit of pushback from the army against Mr. Cameron and the deals he thinks he's doing with Angela Merkel. I'd also harken back to the Iraq war, where we had several units. I mean, I'm thinking particularly about commando units, special forces, for example, that were ordered over to Afghanistan and Iraq at certain times. And there we were, big announcements were made. Tony Blair has arranged for this unit to be deployed, and nothing happened. Basically, the units stayed here. And so there seemed to be a bit of a disconnect between politics and what the armed forces were prepared to do. I wonder what you make of that, and whether you've seen anything similar going on in the US, Patrick.
Not so much in the US, but you know, I do know that there have been long running agreements basically between the United States and French. Britain and France, actually, Anglo-Franco military agreement, which has been done through a series of charities. And this, to me, looks like it was kind of groundwork for taking down barriers between nation states with regards to military.
I mean, for the first time in my life, we were driving along the M5 motorway in the west of England, Patrick, and came across some what looked like quite peculiar troops going in a big convoy. And whilst we were actually in the process of overtaking them, which took something like 15 minutes, a friend of mine in the back was going through the various insignia on the side of these, and they turned out to be French, so possibly part of this deal. But there's definitely an attempt to meld together the European powers under the EU, and not just the political power, obviously, but military and police powers. Yeah, like I say, I think some pushback. But anyway, where do you think that's heading? What does it look like from your side of the pond?
Well, from our side of the pond, it's that the United States needs to have a partner that it can do to intervene with or to intervene on its behalf as well. I think it's found that in Saudi Arabia, in Yemen, recently this year. So they're basically, Saudi Arabia is performing a task that perhaps the United States might have done itself, or maybe Israel or someone else in the past, but now it's being done by Saudi Arabia being able to exert its hegemony in the region. Could be a good or a bad thing. But in terms of Britain's military, I think it's been stripped down quite a bit in recent years, but I think that's to create a sort of dependency, to set it up for a future dependency within an EU army collective. But it's at being able to intervene, Europe to intervene in a much bigger and much more bolder way in conflicts like Syria. Germany is wanting to go all in, as you know. They've moved quickly into that as well. So you've had I've also heard calls from top, some media operatives, if you will, for a European CIA, a European FBI. And so these are all the trap. And also the former Prime Minister of Austria, a European border control, international border force, and a Coast Guard. So these are all the trappings, Tony.
That already exists in the form of this organization Frontex, and we've been doing some investigation into them. This is the European Border Force, looking like actually taking on a kind of paramilitary style in certain countries. No one's really quite sure who they're working for, but some of these migrants who are coming across the Mediterranean actually being assaulted by people who look like they're officials coming from, certainly from official ships, then just robbing them and disappearing off. And that appears to be linked to this organisation Frontex, which is the rather gangster-like appearing European border agency. But look, let's just take a little look at Turkey. Lots and lots of stuff has come out in the last few weeks about Turkey. And obviously with the shooting down of the Russian jet, the Russians are now saying it didn't even enter Turkish airspace. And also threatening possibly to close the Bosphorus. Today, I think it is, Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader, said that he felt that the shooting down of the Russian jet was an invitation to war, but that the Russians were not going to oblige the Turkish. What do you make of Turkey?
Well, Turkey's in a really important geostrategic position. I don't think we need to talk too much about that. It's fairly obvious throughout history. In fact, it's always been that way. Turkey is so crucial, especially if you consider some sort of a war between the West and Russia. Turkey is in reaching distance to the Ukraine, but also right there at the doorstep in Syria. Turkey is also wanting to join the European family of nations. So then it's sharing a border with Syria. Then you have Europe butting up right against the Middle East. So Turkey was the last buffer zone, if you would, between Europe and the Middle East. So that would change things greatly. Turkey is clearly a bad actor. I think that's beyond a doubt now, with regards to not just its facilitating the rise of ISIS, but perhaps even doing business or helping to facilitate the business that's going on there, not just oil trading, but arms, human trafficking, narcotics, weapons, you name it. Turkey's basically into it. And so I don't think the situation in Syria would be allowed to happen or would have been festering this long if not for the role of Turkey. And I think that's beyond debate right now. It's fairly obvious. The problem is Turkey's now making noises, possibly sending tanks to the Ukraine. So you have a potential standoff, sort of almost a war situation between Turkey and Russia. Diplomatic relations are almost frozen. Economic trade or reciprocal sanctions in place. It's not a good scene at all. Very, very dangerous. And if you consider Turkey's being manipulated a lot by the United States and NATO, and it's not a good thing at all. It's to me very unsettling.
What about Syria, though? Because we've now got this situation with the British vote in the House of Commons for bombing Syria. No boots on the ground as yet anyway, but certainly the aircraft, the Royal Air Force are flying sorties now against ISIS. But we had either the same night that the British passed this vote in the House of Commons, or the night after, I'm not sure, the Israelis did a strike just north of Damascus, something which, I mean, I've been following Middle Eastern affairs since my school days, and we always looked at Syria as a potential Third World War hotspot, and the Israelis certainly, ever since the 1967 Six-Day War and also the 1973, the October War, you know, the Yom Kippur War, have been itching to have a bash at Syria. Now they're doing it with hardly anyone noticing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I had a report of a Syrian base which was hit by a U.S. airstrike only a couple of days ago. Of course, the United States has denied this. This was my biggest fear and everyone's biggest fear when they started talking about no-fly zones last year, or even as early as 2013. No-fly zones, basically, that it would turn into Western Air Forces giving air cover to terrorists groups on the ground, with the main objective of overthrowing the government in Damascus. And I think that plan is still active. It's still on the table. The United States just this week did the third rebranding exercise of the moderate opposition. They're calling it the Syrian Arab Coalition, which is very deceptive, considering that the Syrian army is Arab in Syria, and they are the boots on the ground fighting terrorism in Syria. But they're trying to rebrand it, the U.S. So they're trying to put al-Nusra, the Islamic Front, and all these various terrorist organizations that make up the conclave under a banner that's acceptable to sell in the West, which is Syria-Arab Coalition. And so this is a rebranding exercise, and eventually you could meld aspects of ISIS into that coalition too, and no one would notice in the West, because judging by the level of the conversation I saw in the House of Commons with some of the people that voted for this war, they really don't have a clue what's going on the ground. So it'd be very easy to fool them with the sleight of hand of rebranding, which I think that's what's happening. I think that's what it is. It's about protecting a lot of terrorist groups, isolating ISIS as a brand, but then sort of shaving off bits of ISIS into the other terrorist groups, with the end game is to maintain instability in the region, and also to overthrow a regime change in Damascus. And that still has always been and will always be the number one objective. It's not fighting terrorism. It's not defeating ISIS. First, it's regime change, and then they think they can pick up the pieces after that, much like what happened in Libya.
We're now in a situation where there's almost like a kind of standoff, getting ready for a kind of a judo throw between NATO and Russia in Syria. Would you agree? And if so, I mean, where do you see this heading?
I think it's going to be tricky with NATO. NATO has lost a lot of its legitimacy. There's two things. One is Libya. The second is Afghanistan. They're way, way out of their catchment area in Afghanistan, and also in Ukraine as well. NATO it's no secret to anyone that NATO intelligence is active and egging on instability in the Ukraine and now in the Crimea. And there's also reports of Chechenian Islamist fighters, many of whom have done the rotation in Syria, are now fighting in the Crimea. They've had attacks on Crimean infrastructure, specifically the electrical grid, in the last couple of weeks. Plus, you have the neo-Nazi factions, that right sector factions NATO's been working with. This is a really, really ugly multi-front war that's being fought against Russia, essentially. That's my opinion of it, if you look at the Ukraine, Crimea, and Syria. So it's going to be hard for NATO to get in there. I think what they're going to try to do is they'll milk it for a little while longer. Then they need a big crisis to basically call for a European army. And I don't know what that crisis is going to be, Tony, but I know it has to be something significant in order to get the sort of speed movement on that. So I'm not sure what that crisis is going to be, but they definitely will need something big in order to fast track the fusion of the NATO. Will still be there, Tony, but it's not going to be front and center like it is now. It'll be eventually be replaced, and it'll become like an office. It'll become like a kind of a shadow of its former self in Brussels. But the EU army will have preeminence over what NATO used to be.
What do you make of the role of the Paris attacks and the, you've had recently in the States, the San Bernardino shootings?
They're very interesting. They're very interesting. I'm very skeptical of these events generally because of the timing. I'm also skeptical of how quickly policy moves in very quickly in the wake of these. In the case of France, they didn't even wait 48 hours before they waged airstrikes basically in Syrian territory. Didn't really hit anything as the reports came out, empty targets or redundant old U.S. targets. There seems to be a lot of that going on in Syria and northern Iraq as some members of the coalition, including the UK, are hitting targets have been bombed before oil fields and so forth. But the Paris attacks, you look at what's come out of it. It's shutting down European borders. Talk about free society is a bad thing. Freedom of movement is a bad thing. We need to launch more, send more troops, more military assets to the Middle East to fight ISIS. When in fact, the Paris attacks, there is no real forensic case, Tony, that puts ISIS in Paris. Just as there is no actual forensic case that puts ISIS in the Sinai blowing up the Russian plane, nor ISIS in Beirut with the recent Beirut bombings, and or San Bernardino. So, but yet you hear these all rattled off in a list by politicians and media people as if it's like a script that they have to basically repeat this checklist of ISIS has now got a global reach. And a lot of this can be definitely be an illusion, Tony. I like looking at the forensic case, and in the case of San Bernardino, we can't put the the female shooter especially at the scene of the shooting. No one can ID her. They said they're wearing masks. She's a 5 foot four, 120-pound Pakistani housewife. The likelihood of her carrying body armor and a full tactical package and firing a .223 automatic Smith & Wesson rifle is a laughable scenario. Yet this is what is put across as the official story.
Has anybody positively identified them at the scene actually doing the shooting?
No, they haven't. This is something about this case, Tony, that's been glossed over. You could potentially ID a male of a certain, 5'11", 6 foot, because they're both supposedly masked. The reports are the shooters were masked. So there's no support to the idea that the wife, the Muslim housewife who is cooking chicken korma for her husband is going to be G.I. Jane overnight. Just like there is no forensic evidence to put anybody from Syria at the Paris shootings. We do have a fake Syrian passport, which by all intents and purposes looks to be planted at the scene. And also a German minister agrees with me on that. So again, but the talking point, Tony, was that the migrant crisis bled into cause a terrorist event in the heart of Europe. That was the narrative, and they acted immediately. And all these sort of policies are coming into place fast and furious.
Okay, Paris, for example. I mean, what are we dealing with here? Are we dealing with ISIS paratroopers that come in just trained by the SAS, by Navy SEALs, and then disappear out in cars, or maybe are taken out by helicopters? Who's doing these shootings?
Well, I have to look at history, Tony. Is the only thing that we can do is we can look at a historical event in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, whereby no one was actually, I believe, arrested or tried for waging domestic terror, organized domestic terror on European soil, which was Operation Gladio. So this, to me, Paris looks like a classic Gladio style event. And if you look at the policies and the political objectives that were achieved from Paris, it's almost identical in a way to what Gladio sought to achieve through its activities and through various proxy groups and whatever terrorist groups, political extremist factions and so forth. So instead of working through communist parties or the extreme political left or right in Europe, they're just basically using the illusion of Islamic extremist terrorist groups in order to sort of perform the same exact acts, basically. So I don't know what you studied Gladio, Tony, so I know that you could probably weigh in heavily on that. comparison.
Well, yes. I mean, if you have a look at the three-part Alan Frankovich film, which is really probably the easiest and quickest way to assimilate this factual stuff about Gladio, as well as, I mean, it's a little bit easier probably than going through the Italian or the Swiss or the Belgian parliamentary inquiries. I think quite big, thick tomes into that particular operation, as you said, in the 60s, 70s and 80s, and I think possibly into the early 1990s too.
Yes, in the 90s.
You had basically terrorist attacks going on many European countries, particularly Italy, also Germany, Belgium. No one's quite sure about the involvement of this in the Northern Ireland problems, you know, the troubles we had in Northern Ireland. But there's definitely links, and it is now absolutely 100% proven, to fascist elements employed by NATO intelligence in Brussels, and working with very closely with the CIA and MI6 to do the training. A lot of the training was done in Poole in Dorset, a beautiful kind of seaside town where there's a bit of training area for the Navy down there, where a lot of this Gladio training was done. And many of the special forces that were sent in to do these killings of Europeans from European armies were unaware, not necessarily aware of their role. For example, one of the people in the Frankovich documentary talks about his being sent to do a kind of exercise, which obviously as part of his training was perfectly normal, but that exercise was clocking when a supermarket was opened, what time in the morning, how many people were there at the time, who was doing the locking and unlocking, then tracking the person with the keys to the supermarket back to his home, this kind of thing. And then only lo and behold, a few months later, there was a live attack by special forces. It looks as if now it was the SAS that were flown over to do that attack, where the soldiers were wearing carnival masks. And that was what was now known as the Brabant massacres in Belgium. These took place just about the same time as the United States government was trying to put pressure on the Belgian government to keep their cruise missiles, these portable sort of nuclear weapons that drive up and down the motorways and try and hide in the bushes and the woods of Belgium. So there was definitely, you see again, at that time, very much at the same time, a pressure from the US foreign policy on the Belgian government to toe the line. And the effect of the Brabant massacres over several months in the mid-1980s was very, very powerful. It effectively got rid of all resistance to within the Belgian parliament to implementing the cruise missile policy, and the whole of the Belgian parliament pretty much and the people said, well, yes, obviously we need these for our own protection.
Well, look at that, Tony, and then compare that, overlay that to today, and look at how the resistance has just been lifted almost overnight. David Cameron calls for a war vote, opportunistically seizes on the wave of emotion of Paris to do what maybe he wouldn't have been able to do so well at the end of December before Christmas.
Well, he tried 2 years ago and failed miserably. In fact, it was left with egg on his face, wasn't he?
Yeah. So it would have been two times failure there had it not been for Paris. I really don't think they could have mustered up the political will to do that at any other time other than in the immediate aftermath of the Paris attack. So, Tony, I'm getting chills with what you're telling me about Gladio at that time and how quickly they were able to implement things. And I see an exact repeat of this today. So I can only draw the conclusion, Tony, that we are looking at Gladio 2.0 in the 21st century. Because it worked before, why not use it again?
What do you mean by Gladio 2.0? How do you mean?
Well, so the stakes are higher. Now we've got projecting geopolitical aims and missions further afield than even Europe. So this is a much bigger Eurasian play. So this is in with Islamic extremism rather than... So before in the Cold War, communism was a real divisive aspect that could be tapped into in terms of terror, but now it's Islamic extremism. So this is the new communism for the West. This is the new boogeyman of the West now. It's Islamic, radicalized Islam. So with this, you can do a whole lot of manipulation if you can control the parameters of the theater and you can control the stage. you can achieve a lot, basically.
Is it, I mean, is it really all about oil? Because surely the West wouldn't be crazy enough. Our leaders here in the NATO countries wouldn't be crazy enough to go to war with Russia. I mean, Russia has got a few firecrackers up its sleeve.
I don't think it's not just about oil is a part of it. Gas is maybe a bigger part of it than even oil is in terms of sub-regional dominance. Gas is emerged as incredibly important in that respect. Certainly Syria is sitting on top of great deposits. There's a report that just came out that showed that this had been proven in 2005, and all of a sudden we saw hostilities being ramped up after that. But oil and gas, plus we have the military industry, Tony, that in itself is a juggernaut now. This is a multi-hundred-trillion-dollar global industry. That's a juggernaut. We have so many different factors that feed into this. Plus, you have the socio-economic, plus the religious aspects of it. You have old power plays, old geographic power plays of the Halfer Mackinder flavor with Eurasia. Plus, we have the situation with Israel, and you have to look at Israel. Everyone's turned their head away from what's been going on in Jerusalem and the West Bank because of this latest crisis. So again, that's ongoing. That's not stopping, nor is the battle for the Sinai Peninsula. That's an ongoing. We still have peacekeepers in the Sinai, U.S. troops, 700 of them, to basically watch what Egypt and Israel are doing in the Sinai Peninsula. So still today, after all these years. So these are all live plays, as is Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of pressure on the Saudi monarchy right now, too, on many fronts. And I there's noises coming out of CIA that, I quote, the Saudi royal family is not long for this world. End of quote. I heard that last week from a CIA operative. So there's a lot going on, Tony, and stakes are high. They've never been higher, and Syria is right in the middle of it.
Patrick, where do we find your work online? Where's the best place?
The best place is 21stcenturywire.com, but also I have stuff on globalresearch.ca and a few things elsewhere that gets syndicated, but mainly 21stcenturywire.com.
Patrick Henderson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston, and St Albans in the past. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week in the Sirius special, that is Patrick Chalmers from author of Fraudcast News, former Reuters journalist, and Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire, the website that critiques the mainstream media, particularly when it comes to geopolitics and terrorism propaganda. And also thanks to studio engineer Rick Margetts. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.